getting free from the chains of racism and patriarchy.
If you are committed to these ideas of freedom, and I think a person that is free has to be committed to questioning what is freedom almost in every instance and in every choice. And we've already discussed how ingrained certain ideas like white supremacy and patriarchy that are invested in the mythologies of race and gender and norms for what it means to be American. And if you're not invested in those hierarchies and you don't even reflect physically, emotionally, or mentally those hierarchies, then every negotiation, whether interpersonal or institutional, has to go back to that question, is this aiding in my ideas of freedom or not?
That's Damaris Hill. We talk with her about her book of poems and other writings, A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing. Then, at a time that our public lands and ocean territories are being auctioned off for exploitation by the oil and gas industries, Stephen Nash examines the case of the Grand Canyon. His book is Grand Canyon for Sale, Public Lands versus Private Interests in the Era of Climate Change. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. From Harriet Tubman to Sandra Bland and Black Lives Matter, Black women freedom fighters have braved violence, scorn, despair, and isolation to fight for their rights. In A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing, Damaris Hill honors their experiences with responses to her heroes that are both harrowing and hopeful. In her love poems, as she calls them, to such women as Harriet Tubman, Zora Neale Thurston, Ida B. Wells, Eartha Kitt, and others, she pays homage to women who broke the bounds that racism and sexism tried to silence them with. She also honors women of lesser renown who fought back against chains, literal and otherwise, sometimes by violence, sometimes by breaking the law, but always with unbounded courage. Using poems, other writings, and photographs, Hill explores the different meanings of being bound, from slavery and incarceration to being bound to those we love, or bound for freedom. Damaris Hill's books include The Fluid Boundaries of Suffrage and Jim Crow, and a poetry collection, Visible Textures. A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing is out from Bloomsbury Publishing. In addition to being a writer, Damaris Hill teaches creative writing and English literature, African American studies, and women's studies at the University of Kentucky. Damaris Hill, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm so happy to talk to you.
Well, this was just a terrific book, not just of poems, but also of these kind of prose poem mini biographies. Very moving. A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing. The Incarceration of African American Women, from Harriet Tubman to Sandra Bland. You say the poems in the book are love letters. Love letters?
Yes. I come from a religious tradition as far as my upbringing. Most of the people in my family, they are ministers. I was very much raised in the Methodist church. And being a creative child, of course, some of my first exposure to art, including music, visual art, and literature, was all biblically based in a very Methodist, which is a type of intellectual Christian tradition. And I think the idea of the hymn sticks with me even when I try to avoid it in my poetry. And so that's what I mean by like love songs and praise songs. Probably my earliest exposure was like a hymn, and maybe my knowledge of those types of love letters and praise songs evolved from there.
They also are poems of struggle, though. You know, you write that they will not comfort.
Yeah, I meant that.
and I can attest to that. They're strong. They're strong poems. So Talk about this twinning of love and struggle.
Well, it was important to me that I kept those parallels in the poems. And I don't know if it's the twinning of love and struggle, but I definitely wanted to explore or try to explore in each poem the multiple entendres of bound. And if I was going to use the historical context with a negative connotation of oppressed or meaning fettered or held back, I also wanted to provide an opportunity in the poem for the subject in the poem to actually spring away from that or to find connections in love and provide a positive outlet in addition to the historical negative connotation.
You say that writing the poems have forced you to question what it means for a Black woman to engage in resistance. Could you explain that?
Well, we know that there's been significant cultural shifts over the past recent years about what are the mass messages about America and ideas of democracy and liberty and the polarizations of, let's say, rights and amendment. And so being a former service member and investing in these ideas of Americanness and nationhood in multiple ways in my professional life, as a writer, as a researcher, again, as an armed service member, as a civil servant that was once a public teacher, and seeing how these ideas have been exploited and distorted in recent years. You know, violence is being passed off as democracy. And violence has always been an integral part of the American fabric. But now it's being given away wholesale in exchange for civil rights.
Are you talking, say, for example, about the white nationalists at Charlottesville?
I'm talking about Charlottesville. I'm talking about an individual prejudice that results in killings. I'm talking about collective prejudice and this belief in the mythology of white supremacy.
Do you think that it's something that has been strengthened or more just revealed by Trump?
Oh, I think it's been more revealed and is being marketed, because I think people that invest in white supremacy may be invested in white supremacy because the alternative would be to consider how white supremacy is not working in their favor.
Yeah.
Right? That's the alternative. Really dealing with the complicated notions of white privilege and how much privilege is not being accessed in whiteness in the same way that it has been before.
Divide and conquer is the way I talk about it.
Oh, yeah. You know, sometimes I theorize and I speculate and I wonder, what happened to all of this talk about the 1%? That seems to be gone. And now we have a more polarizing perspective of America.
Well, I think we could go down and talk about this quite a bit.
We can go down that rabbit hole and be there for a very long time, couldn't we?
Exactly. But I'd actually like to get back to your wonderful book.
Oh, thanks.
A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing. So, and really this, it's certainly relevant to what we're talking about. In fact, your second section, I'm going to jump to that, is titled Bound, Fettered. Tell us, what are the multiple meanings of these two words for you in this book?
Well, you know, the book is in seven sections, I believe, six or seven sections. And bound, of course, I chose the word bound because it's a multiple entendre. So I open the book. The first chapter in the book is talking about how I'm bound to my ancestors, blood relatives, and otherwise. And then the end of the book is talking about how I'm bound to the next generation in terms of motherhood and what I owe the loyalty to the next generation. But in between, I talk about bound in the negative connotation of being fettered. I talk about bound in terms of demarcation. What does it mean to bind a book, to write something down, to make this statement in this very specific way that we value when we historicize things and create national narratives? What does it mean to be bound in that way? I also talk about bound in terms of philosophy and being hemmed in. What does it mean to be bound intellectually or to buy in intellectually to other belief systems?
And you also say at one point that using formal poetic structure is a way of being bound. And when I thought about that, I thought, you know, there are ways to be bounded or limited that inspire creativity. And it seems to me that that's one of them, to use the strictures of a poetic form.
Yes. So I think it's Toni Morrison, but I may be wrong, that says that writing is not only a matter of life, it's a matter of language. And so when we really start to unpack values in what we consider like, you know, high art and low art, or folk culture versus national and international like artistic mediums, language in terms of literature is a very integral part of that, right? And so what I'm playing with in the second section in terms of those women, that many of them were escaping chattel slavery or just coming out of a state of chattel slavery. They moved to Philadelphia, right? Because they believe that Philadelphia is the city of brotherly love and the seed of democracy in this country, right? This is the place where Americanness happens. And so these Black women migrate here. And when they migrate to Philadelphia in between the 1890s and 1910, as Callie Ann Gross talks about in Colored Amazons, they find themselves battling different forms of constraints and bondage. So rather than chattel slavery, there are economic constraints, there's open discrimination, there are limitations in the types of work that they can do because of education and or discrimination. So there are all of these additional social circumstances that limit their access to this American idea that motivated them to come to Philadelphia.
And some of them really, really fight back. And
some of them do fight back. And I just get so tickled at the ways that they fight back. Like Black Bess and Mermaid Stroll. I love that she's trying to convince men that she's a prostitute. And as soon as she gets in a dark corner, she's robbing them and keeping all of her goodies. It's brilliant. I love it.
And, you know, you also point out the different ways that Black women and white women were, you know, who did fight back or who were, you know, went outside, outside convention, how they were treated, that Black women were judged to be criminal and white women were judged to be insane.
Absolutely. And I think we're still on some levels dealing with that distortion and that demonization of Black women acting against the norms. You know, there's an assumption of confusion and victimhood if white women act outside of the norms or if they evade expectations. But if Black women evade expectations or sometimes even meet expectations in a way that doesn't please people, they're often demonized and criminalized.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Damaris Hill about her narrative in verse, A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing. Yeah, you say at a certain point, it's costly to stay free and appear sane.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Say more about that.
Well, if you are committed to these ideas of freedom, right? And I think a person that is free has to be committed to questioning what is freedom almost in every instance and in every choice. And we've already discussed how ingrained certain ideas like white supremacy and patriarchy that are invested in the mythologies of race and gender and norms, right? For what it means to be American. And if you're not invested in those hierarchies and you don't even reflect physically, emotionally, or mentally those hierarchies, then every negotiation, whether interpersonal or institutional, has to go back to that question, is this aiding in my ideas of freedom or not? And what are the benefits and consequences of that? And so that's what I mean, that it is costly to be free and appear sane, because my ideas of freedom don't always match up with those institutional expectations or the expectations of the person that I'm having an interpersonal relationship with.
That must have been incredibly difficult when you know, part of the armed forces. I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, I can't imagine a more hierarchical structure, one in which to be a soldier means to suppress your own individual reality. So talk about the contradiction, the tension, and how do you resolve it?
Well, let me first say that this book is an exploration and there are many things that are unresolved, right? I'm just still evolving. And that's definitely one of them. You know, I kind of go into that in The Patriot and the Prisoner, which we definitely don't have time to read because it's a longer piece. But it explores my personal and intellectual investments in nationalism and scales them against the most formative relationship of my life, which means my relationship to my son.
Say more about that.
Oh, I don't know what else there is to say.
Well, you talk about your son who grew up with a beautiful spirit. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel in some way got ground down by the system, and who yeah. has tried to cope with that by, abusing substances.
Absolutely. That is a correct assumption. My son grew up in the era of hope, prior to the era of hope. As early as 2000, he was invested in like the news and politics. He was already expressing interest in that. You know, like most mothers, I invest in whatever my child wants to develop as far as his talents. And for my son, those talents included politics. My son was post-racial prior to the recent cultural conversion of 2015 and specifically 2016. Very aware and knowledgeable of national politics on an intimate level. And so I think what began for him, the struggle began for him probably as early as Trayvon Martin, but definitely when the Michael Brown verdict happened, because we talked about it on the phone. And then from there, his disappointment in the blatant devaluing of Blackness in this country, I think it began to fray him, you know? And we talked about it often when before we never had to discuss it. So I want to also say that being a parent of any child is hard. But being a parent of a Black child in America, when you know white supremacy is looming, when you know discrimination is looming, and to promote that child's visions and dreams is a real strategic feat. And I thought we had accomplished that. And then once we are in college and, you know, my son is making strategic choices about his major and his friends based on his ambitions for politics. And then we have this incessant intoxication, incessant toxic, assault that begins to invade all layers and fabrics of public and private life. And so being a college student, heavily invested in politics, it can be a space with very little diversity. For the first time ever, he had to wrestle with the ideas that his white friends did not acknowledge his blackness. They did not acknowledge it.
A terrible disappointment coming on the heels of a black president.
On the heels of a black president, at the toes of a white supremacist president, in the midst of your college career, which is supposed to be some of the happiest and most social points of your life, you know, on the eve of your professional career as a politician and realizing that your peers don't acknowledge your blackness is probably a lot to struggle with.
Yeah, and this is echoed in the book very much, in this book, A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing, Damaris Hill. You know, the third section, bound/demarcation, boundaries, you write about the women who wrote about this kind of oppression. For example, you open the section with Ida B. Wells. Tell us about her, and, you know, she documented lynchings.
So Ida B. Wells was important, number one, because her life is a testament to the challenges of white supremacy, but also the ways that she demanded that people acknowledge the ways that white supremacy violence was affecting her and her community. So Ida B. Wells was important because most of us know her as a journalist and an educator. But I want people to understand that in the 1870s and 90s, right? Well, in the 1890s, she was on the forefront of demography and statistical documentation. And we don't talk about her in that very specific, high intellectual context. The journalism was for everyone else. It was to translate the statistics that she had been keeping. And she had networks. This is a black woman, a young black woman, who has networks all across the country where people are phoning into her and telling her about each lynching that's happening in their region. And she's keeping statistics. And then she's using the statistics in her newspapers to educate black people and non-black people and others about the violences that are happening in America. And yeah, I think what's happening in A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing in that section, in terms of demarcation and boundaries, is there are a few women that are noted in that chapter that are absolute geniuses that history and most narratives refuse to acknowledge their genius. And Ida B. Wells is definitely one of them.
And Zora Neale Hurston is another. I mean, she was acknowledged later. You know, we read about her. But in her own time, she died in poverty as a maid. So tell us about Zora Neale Hurston.
Well, I wrote specifically about Zora Neale Hurston in a context of her inspirations of becoming a writer and an anthropologist and just being a young woman. I mean, it's important to remember, you know, Zora as this sassy, unbothered, unrestrained, unbound intellectual, right? But when we think about her as a young woman in this emergent field of anthropology, where being a woman and being anything less than white, that the entire discipline believed that you were biologically inferior and less intelligent than any white guy in the room. For her to be in this field was remarkable, and I cannot imagine the amount of bias, scrutiny, negativity that she must experience in this one space. To have to study these mythologies of inferiority in order to receive your certification as a scientist must have been grueling at certain points. And then for me, imagining her experience without the burden of femininity and sexuality and the exotic desires of the men in this space is impossible. So I'm just talking about the intellectual burdens, but imagine the hashtag Me Too burdens that she was experiencing in this space.
Exactly. I mean, and that's certainly been true of other great African-American writers. Is it Toni Morrison and Beloved, for example?
Yeah, I mean, that, but also, yeah, like on, in the literary scape, but also these scientists that are obsessed with these hierarchies and the disposabilities of people that may or certainly do, some of them at least, have these ideas of sexual exoticism and savagery associated with Black women, right? And so I can't imagine how resilient Zora had to be to survive that space. I also want to like note that we don't talk about, and I think I found this in one of the archival pieces that were online about Zora Neale Hurston, that she was the archivist at an Air Army base that became Cape Canaveral in Florida. Can you imagine? And I think that that document said that she was fired for knowing too much. Yeah, right?
What you were just talking about, the exoticism, you know, I think of Josephine Baker, for example, who you don't write about here, but who also was a figure who played within the stereotype of that kind of exoticism and yet totally transcended it.
Very subversively, which was indicative of her time and space, of negotiating that space and negotiating her power in that space to make gains for people, right? But it's also important to know that that wasn't only Josephine Baker's tactic, but that's also Esther's tactic from the Bible, right? So this idea of subversively negotiating power for the collective good is not something that exclusively happened in an African-American context, but has a much larger tradition in terms of negotiating power for people who historically don't have any.
You also talk about Eartha Kitt, another one of these women who transcended stereotypes.
So I find this so funny, right? Because like we're talking about the erasure of Blackness. And like I think Eartha Kitt was one of those people in the 1950s and 60s that was embraced in a certain type of politic that was about unification and about the erasure of difference. And I'm not taking anything away from her talent. She was immensely talented as well. But she was one of those people who were included in that, right? And so she's invited to the White House for this type of summit and talk with Lady Bird Johnson. And apparently when she gets there, everybody's talking about table linen and the type of flowers that they want to align the highway. And she was like, well, I want to talk about Vietnam. I want to talk about how many Black and brown boys are dying. And then by the time she left the White House, it was already in the paper that she had made Lady Bird Johnson cry.
That's so powerful.
Yeah. And so it became this Eartha Kitt is a bully situation. And then from then on, she was being investigated by some of the highest offices in the United States and essentially blackballed. She did not work in the United States for at least a decade. She went back to her hotel. She had tour dates. And people spoke about her tour dates not existing, her hotel reservations being canceled, and her earnings were effectively stopped because she asked that question. Yeah, and I think it was a very painful thing for Eartha Kitt. So, of course, the popular memory of Eartha Kitt is all of her successes and the love that we had for her as fans. But people don't discuss how at the moment when she expressed concern for others, she was demonized.
And the CIA called her a sadistic nymphomaniac, which is...
Absolutely. That's exactly what they called her, a sadistic nymphomaniac.
I mean, just deconstruct that for a minute. Those two words put together are very peculiar.
And they hearken to ideas that I spoke about earlier about Black femininity, right? Not only criminal, but also very sexually available, right?
Exactly. And another person you talk about who talked about intersectionality, which I hadn't known about, was Fannie Lou Hamer.
Absolutely.
Tell us about her.
Well, Fannie Lou Hamer, of course, was an amazing person and continued to fight for the liberties of all and civil rights and to protest even in the face of death, rape, physical acts of violence that include beating, and continue to advocate for democracy. You know, it's so funny that on some of the national narratives, there are ideas about the enemy within, and it seems like Black women are disproportionately identified as the enemy within. But all of the Black women that I know, Fannie Lou Hamer, Angela Davis, Assata Shakur, Shirley Chisholm, these women that really call people to task on democracy are rarely acknowledged as being some of the most fundamental believers in democracy. You have to have a religious fervor for democracy in order to call people to task about what democracy should be and should not be. And that is not acknowledged. Yet people that are little invested in the ideas of democracy and use the term as a type of social currency, which has no substance or backing, are thought of being the upholders of democracy. It's just an irony or a truth of the United States that we rarely acknowledge. And I hope that this book begins to acknowledge that.
And it certainly does. I mean, this has been a fascinating conversation, but there's so much more in this book. A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing, The Incarceration of African American Women from Harriet Tubman to Sandra Bland. Thank you so much, Damaris Hill, for talking with us here.
Thank you so much, Francesca.
Damaris Hill, in addition to A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing, she's also the author of The Fluid Boundaries of Suffrage and Jim Crow and a poetry volume, Visible Textures. Next up, The Grand Canyon for Sale. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. President Trump just signed a bill creating 5 new national monuments and expanding some national parks. That's a good thing. But before we celebrate, we need to take note of the unrelenting assault on public lands being waged by this administration. Trump has opened up the Atlantic coastline to massive oil and gas drilling, with the sale of leases to dirty energy companies going on right now. Thousands of acres of public land in Wyoming are at risk for oil and gas drilling, although a federal judge has just temporarily blocked those plans, asking the administration to show the impact on climate change. Trump's latest budget proposal slashes Interior Department spending on conservation by 75%. But sadly, while Trump may have the worst record on environmental protection of any modern president, the exploitation of public lands for private profit has been a policy of both Republican and Democratic administrations. Even iconic treasures like the Grand Canyon have not been exempt. Stephen Nash's book, Grand Canyon for Sale, is a carefully researched investigation of the precarious future of America's public lands, our national parks, forests, wildlife refuges, monuments, and wildernesses. Taking the Grand Canyon as his key example, Nash shows how climate change and a growing right-wing political movement to break up federal lands and return them to state, local, and private control could devastate our national wilderness heritage. Stephen Nash has reported on science, the environment, and other topics for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Scientist, and other venues. He's visiting senior research scholar at the University of Richmond in California, where he's taught in the journalism and environmental studies programs since 1980. Steve Nash, welcome to Writer's Voice. This is just a wonderful book, Grand Canyon for Sale, although the title is a disturbing one. Public lands versus private interests in the era of climate change. I wonder if you have the book there. Do you?
Yes.
Wonderful. I wonder if you could read the paragraph that begins at the bottom of page 2 and goes to the top of page 3. And the reason I'm asking that is I think it really sums up what's at stake here. It kind of sums up the threats.
The frigid clarity of the once warm and silty Colorado River, new since the advent of the Glen Canyon Dam upstream, has all but extinguished native fish species. The prolific tamarisk trees, arivistes from Central Asia, have severely disrupted native plant and animal communities along the river's banks. Then there's the dirty haze from smokestacks and tailpipes, and the hybrid beefalo herd that is overgrazing and eroding fragile rangeland, where such animals, even native buffalo, have never roamed. All are evidence of lapses in our stewardship of this globally revered sanctuary. So is the ceaseless staccato of the air tour choppers and the fact that the condors are still being poisoned.
Yeah, I asked you to read that because it really sums up so many of the threats. It doesn't tell us yet the reason why we've fallen down on the stewardship, and that's very much the subject of your book, Grand Canyon for Sale. But it gives us a sense of what we have lost in this land that was supposed to be preserved as it was in perpetuity.
Exactly. It's a wonderful phrase of federal scientist who works for the Park Service once told me, yeah, we're in the perpetuity business, and we're doing that on a yearly budget cycle and a four-year presidential cycle. Our politics aren't in perpetuity, but the parks are supposed to be protected from all that.
Yeah, exactly. So you say that public lands, which take up a huge amount, actually, of our national lands, the public lands are up for grabs. First, how much land are we talking about? And then what do you mean, up for grabs?
It astonishes most people. It certainly did me when I first encountered it, that about one-third of our national landscape is in public hands. It belongs to all of us. Public land of various kinds. It's not private. The reason that characterizing all of that enormous landscape as up for grabs is that we're in an era now where there is a very concerted move to privatize all of that public land or all of it that has any value, to extract minerals and gas and oil and forget about any other uses that it may have, to turn it into a business venture to enrich private individuals and corporations. That's why it's up for grabs.
Yeah, and how much of a threat, how much do you think that could actually happen?
I think it's happening right now. The move to privatize public lands has accelerated since Trump was elected. But even before that and throughout the history of public lands and the national park system, there's been an understandable effort to realize the profits, the private profits that can be made from whatever's on that public land, whether it's a bunch of tourists or a bunch of oil wells. But it's accelerating now because political landscape has been changing.
Yeah. So this book focuses on the Grand Canyon, which, of course, is one of the most astonishing landscapes in the world and a place that is one of my very favorite places on Earth. I had the great good fortune of going down the Colorado River in 1993. And even then, I remember that there was the threat of some kind of a hotel that was going to be built at the confluence of the Colorado River, and what is the river that comes into it near the Glen Canyon Dam? There was a hotel that was threatened to be built there, and then I don't think it was. But those development threats have not gone away.
No, and they'll always continue. If you make a bargain that you will preserve national parks, Grand Canyon, and all the rest of them in perpetuity, then you also have to guarantee that you're going to be around or somebody's going to be around to protect them from exploitation. We have a very powerful economic system that looks for opportunities. And again, it's understandable and natural and predictable that if there are opportunities on public lands, Grand Canyon or anywhere else, that there will be people around to try to make use of them for private gain. And some of that is legitimate. We're used to that. If there's tourism, then there should be people on the outskirts of public lands who can supply the goods and services that tourists need. That's all natural. At some point, though, that kind of exploitation begins to move into the natural systems of the park and really destroy them in order to make a profit. And that's what we should be guarding against.
You talk about a development that is happening in a town that was actually created right on the edge of the park, Tusayan.
Yes.
And talk about how that happened. And when you say, you know, these are things that could be in the service of people who use the park, but this is a massive threat to the water supplies of the park.
Yeah. The problem, I guess you could pick out several things and say, yeah, this is the root problem behind it all, but so I won't do that. But the difficulty for us is if we love our national parks and enjoy them, if we take those trips down the Colorado as you did back in the 90s, and what a wonderful trip that must have been.
It was.
We take them for granted a bit because we figure they'll always be there. But as eternal as Grand Canyon looks, it's vulnerable, especially the wildlife, the natural systems, the animals. They depend on factors that if we try to exploit them, those natural systems fail. And water is a great example. I'm going to abbreviate this answer sooner or later, Francesca.
Fine.
Tusayan's a tiny little town at the edge of Grand Canyon. It has always subsisted on the kind of river of money that flows into Grand Canyon. We all want to see the Grand Canyon, and we all bring our resources with us. And that tourism has kept this little town of 500 permanent residents afloat. But there are a couple of private landowners there, especially an Italian corporation, the Stilo Corporation, who own some of the land at the outskirts of the canyon. And they see an opportunity. And the opportunity that they would like to develop is going to be the third largest shopping mall in America, if it's allowed to continue. Well, that is an ugly thing to put at the outskirts of a global natural wonder like Grand Canyon. But beyond that, that kind of development threatens the underground water supplies that feed the nature of the Grand Canyon. Something like 80% of the life of Grand Canyon is sustained in the small seeps and springs and watercourses because it's a very arid climate. The few places where water occurs in the canyon are the places where most of the life is. And it may be, nobody knows for sure, that giant new developments at the edge of the canyon, like the one that's proposed, will suck away the water that canyon life depends on.
Yes, and that's just one of the many threats you speak about, Stephen Nash, in this book, Grand Canyon for Sale. You know, it's interesting, you start your second chapter, so right at the beginning of the book, you focus on invasive species, and at first I wondered why, and then it became clearer as I read through the chapter, but tell us why you focused on them.
Invasive species are an example of something that looks natural. These are species, if you live in the East like I do, species like kudzu, sometimes we hear about killer bees, other things that are imported, Argentine fire ants. There are a whole lot of insects and diseases and plants that we kind of import into the U.S. And then they cut loose sometimes and they begin to unravel natural systems. It's another threat. And it looks kind of natural, like this is something that just happens in nature. It's not happening for natural reasons. It's happening because we have decided not to exert ourselves to protect those natural systems. We're allowing people to be really careless and import more kudzu or the equivalent of kudzu and killer bees and fire ants all the time. Other nations, particularly Australia and New Zealand are good examples, have made sure to have careful inspection processes so invasive species don't get in. Well, at Grand Canyon, which is the quintessential kind of American landscape in a way, there are already dozens of imported species. That wouldn't matter so much except that they threaten the native species that are there. They tilt the natural systems in a way that makes for a lot less biological diversity and a lot less healthy ecosystems, even in a place like the Grand Canyon, which seems so safe and so remote.
Yeah, you talk about the tamarisk trees, which, you know, I saw everywhere, and I thought they were completely native. I mean, they looked like they were. So, yeah. As you say, but they suck up a huge amount of water, which deprives other species of the water they need to survive.
Exactly. Yeah, thank you for mentioning tamarisk. They are all along the Colorado River at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, and they are actually in dozens of states across the U.S. They have an enormous taproot. It goes down dozens of feet, and it's really efficient at pulling out water. Also, sometimes they're called salt cedars because when they drop their needles, they kill most other kinds of vegetation around the base of the tree. So they're very good at kind of taking over a landscape. Well, again, it wouldn't be much of a big deal for an invasive like tamarisk to come and join the happy throng of species in our national parks, except they tend to kill off the native ecosystems that are part of the reasons why the parks were created.
I mean, U.S. Border and Customs Control, aren't they supposed to be minding the store?
They are supposed to be minding the store, and they try. But they're up against the kind of political opposition that is fueling every sort of threat to the parks and the public lands. Our politics in this era depend a lot, as you know, depend a lot on who's paying the bills, who's got the money. Those are the people with the political clout. So trade organizations of various kinds that don't want careful inspection and careful regulation have made sure that really we have a very loose and sloppy system of inspection at our borders. They don't want trade to slow down. They don't want it to get even minimally more expensive in order to keep invasives out.
Yet not one asylum seeker shall be allowed to pass.
Yeah. You know, it's easy with the invasive species issue, which isn't the biggest threat to Grand Canyon or any place else. So it's important, and it's worth looking at and worrying through and doing something about. But it's easy to mix up the invasive species issue with our kind of acrimonious national debate about immigration and exotics, people who are coming here from other countries. The two don't relate at all.
So you also have a chapter called Landscapes in Motion. This area, the Grand Canyon, the Southwest, went through a previous period of climate change disruption where, you know, the communities that had been there for, 12,000 years had to leave because of a mega drought. We're facing those kinds of conditions very possibly again in this century and beyond. You have some pretty shocking maps about what you call the migration of our national parks southward in an era of climate change, but what you're really talking about is the migration of heat zones northward. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. You can move the picture in either direction. It is getting hotter. In fact, a new paper, a scientific paper, was just announced this week that says that globally, the Earth is hotter than it's been for the last 115,000 years. That, of course, is going to affect our national parks. And as you said, you can either think of the parks as moving south into hotter latitudes, or you can think of the heat as moving north. So the book includes some maps that try to illustrate what that looks like conceptually. The plants and the animals that have to adapt to those conditions, if we're lucky, they will be able to adapt, have to be able to migrate to cooler climates, either northerly in most cases or upslope if they're in mountainous areas, to places where they can tolerate the amount of heat that's coming. We talked about real estate development and we talked about invasive species, and they are very important. But if there's one issue of all of the threats facing national parks and public lands that is overarching, that's more important than all the rest, it's climate change. And what we need to be doing is guaranteeing that public lands are open for that migration of natural species that's going to have to take place. We have to keep those opportunities open for them if there's a chance for any of them to survive.
So what you're really saying is it's not just about protecting the national parks, but all the public lands that buffer them.
We're fortunate to have those public lands. We should be thinking of all of them as national parks at this point. We have to open the boundaries of the national park, so to speak, and allow those species out to move into areas where they can survive. If we continue to exploit public lands to sell them off for coal mines and oil wells and other kinds of uses for roading and real estate development, that cuts off those survival chances when climate change begins to bite even harder than it already is.
You also talk about species extinctions that have already happened. In fact, I was shocked to read in your book, Stephen Nash, in Grand Canyon for Sale, that the Grand Canyon has lost 20% of its mammals?
It has, and we're coming up in 2019 on the 100th anniversary of the creation of Grand Canyon as a national park. So those losses have taken place on our watch, so to speak, nationally. It's a difficult proposition to protect natural systems in national parks, even one as big as Grand Canyon. I think it's 1.5 million acres altogether. It's not enough to guarantee the survival of species unless you have a lot of buffer around the edge and unless you do a lot to protect those species.
Right. And so let's talk about a couple of the species that you that you tell the stories of in this book, In Grand Canyon for Sale. The condor. I mean, I remember, again, I think this was back in the early 90s. I was in California, and I actually saw somebody going around with one of those kind of portable radio detectors.
Oh, telemetry, yeah.
Yes, telemetry. And they were tracking one of the 9 condors, I think, that had been reintroduced or had been just introduced into the wild. You say that's been a success story, but one that we are really at risk of turning into a failure.
Condors are absolutely magnificent. They have a 9-foot wingspan. They're really intelligent, and in a kind of a bizarre way, they're sort of playful, and you can see them at Grand Canyon because we spent millions of dollars introducing them there. They hadn't been there for more than a century because they'd been exterminated by European settlers over time, but they were reintroduced 20-odd years ago, and they're a big success story at Grand Canyon. They're an example of a species that was on the absolute brink of extinction. But now the population has grown. They're still highly endangered, but they're back on the landscape. Problem is that they are only being propped up with a whole lot more money and a huge amount of effort on the part of scientists and volunteers because we keep poisoning them with lead shot. The U.S. Forest Service has declined, and so has the U.S. Bureau of Land Management, to ban hunting with lead ammunition. Condors eat carrion, And so they find deer. They do a very good job of cleaning up when animals die. That's the business that they're in. But if those animals have been shot with lead shot, then they ingest the lead and it kills them. That's the leading cause of death of all those expensive condors that we've reintroduced to the landscape. It's an example of our failure to, and pardon me if I sound like a two-bit evangelist, Francesca, but it's an example of our failure to prioritize. What's important to us here? Is it the ability to use lead shot instead of copper? Is that so important? Well, politically, it is. The National Rifle Association doesn't want anybody telling them they have to use copper buckshot on public lands. So that's why condors continue to die. And if we just left them alone out there, they'd be gone in 20 years, according to the scientists who take care of them. Instead, we go through arduous and painful and super expensive processes to remove the lead from the condors, and they're still dying. That population is barely hanging on, even with all this extra effort, just because of the politics of the situation. It's priorities, and we haven't yet got the priorities of natural systems and these wonderful species at the top of our list.
Yeah, and as you point out, Stephen Nash, this is the priority of a tiny percentage of the electorate, actually.
You say
vast majorities of people who are polled on this in these same states where this, you know, in Arizona, for example, support taking the lead out of the bullets, you know, of using copper bullets instead of lead bullets. But it is the NRA and the guys, I guess, who manufacture these bullets, who they are so in bed with, who are pushing this agenda.
Well, they're very good at what they do, and which we can describe in various ways, but you have to hand it to the NRA. They are very effective at raising money and at exercising political pressure. So are the real estate developers. So are the gas and oil drillers and the coal miners. So are the people who are into unregulated trade opportunities. Until the rest of us who are really convinced that national parks and public lands are important, unless we begin to fight as effectively as those people and push back, they're going to keep winning, and the parks are going to keep losing.
And that's a tall order, because they tend to have the deep pockets.
I think there are a lot of deep pockets among those of us who think that natural landscapes are of really, really supreme importance. I think we have deep pockets, too. I just don't think the threat is on our radar yet.
Right, and that's why your book, Stephen Nash, your book, Grand Canyon for Sale, is so important. So you mentioned before coal and gas. You talk a bit in this book about the Navajo Reservation. Again, you know, I'm very familiar with this area. I can remember at the Four Corners, I can remember flying over, actually, the coal plant that's there and seeing the pollution, and then being on the ground in the area and also seeing the pollution that comes from that plant. There is a struggle now between coal and solar for the heart of the Navajo Reservation. Talk about that.
Well, in the post-war era, the 1970s and late 60s, in the Four Corners area, which is very remote, but there are several Indian tribes in that area, and there's some coal, it became an opportunity to build some gigantic power plants. And the Navajo Generating Station, which is one of them, it's very, very near the boundary of Grand Canyon, has the tallest smokestacks and some of the biggest pollution in the United States. It generates electric power that goes across large distances by burning coal. The problem is it also pollutes the atmosphere. It creates a lot of the haze that makes Grand Canyon difficult even to see across on many days of the year. There have been moves to shut down those generating stations, especially the Navajo generating stations, or clean them up, and some progress has been made in that. But it's not as easy as snapping your fingers and saying, as I would like to, gee, let's have a bunch of solar panels instead. Arizona's full of sunshine. Those deserts would be a great place to generate solar power. The problem is that those power plants supply really good paying jobs for Navajo tribes and Hopi tribes that need them. So they've kind of worked their way into their own constituency there. Again, it's priorities. The federal government paid tens of millions of dollars to get those plants built. If the federal government stepped in again and said, we have to clean up the air pollution in Grand Canyon and complete that job, which has been started over the past decades, if we decided to do that, we could do it with federal funding of solar power, which is the best direction to go, as we know, for a lot of reasons, to get away from fossil fuels, climate change being at the top of the list. But it's hard because it means some economic dislocation, and it means the politics have to change so that the Navajo and the Hopi tribes are still taken care of, that transition is something that doesn't make victims of them.
President Trump pardoned the ranchers whose grazing of their herds on public lands for free, basically, led to sparked the Bundy takeover of the Oregon Refuge. This isn't about the Grand Canyon, but I wonder if you could weigh in on the almost the cultural threat to public lands as represented not only by this pardon, but by the original Bundy takeover as it occurred.
The problem with addressing anything that connects to the Trump administration is that it's like almost a total eclipse. It sort of obliterates most other considerations because it's so crazy. The difficulty with public lands and cattle grazing, and you're right to say that's where this began, that predated Donald Trump. It started 100 years ago. So let's put the Trump administration at the margins for the moment and just boil down cattle grazing this way. We've got these public lands, and on enormous expanses of them, just tens of thousands of square miles, we allow cattle grazing, which seems like a good use for what looks like just empty, remote places. The problem is the cattle don't belong there. They eat the landscape. The wild species that depend on that landscape suffer as a result and in many cases disappear. There are often examples of overgrazing where the landscape is wrecked. Cattle help introduce invasives to wide stretches of the landscape, and they foul the water sources, which are especially precious in that arid kind of area. It costs more to administer our federal grazing programs on these public lands. It costs more to administer than it brings in because the lease rates for those enormous tracts of public land are so cheap. But that's okay. The real problem is that the cattle, they're innocent. But the cattle, again, because of our political priorities, are wrecking those watersheds. And it really matters, once again, to the survival of natural systems that are going to be as healthy as we can possibly make them in order to be resilient when climate change kicks in.
I think that's very important, that what you're saying is that the very structure of how this has been set up has been deeply problematic. And yet added to it now, we have the example of people who are even flouting the minimal kind of payments into the public trust. It's like saying that public trust, to me, the message was public lands don't belong to the public. They belong to private interests. And that in some ways, the ranchers who were doing that were doing nothing different than what the coal and gas interests are also saying.
That's exactly right. There is a distinction to be made, and I'm glad you're disturbed by the idea of people carrying assault rifles into public lands, taking over facilities, insisting that land is theirs. I'm upset by that, too, and I don't think those folks should be pardoned or encouraged the way one of our national parties has been. But they are really a kind of a sideshow. The reason they can get away with it is because some very powerful and a lot less visible interests want them to. The ones who want to privatize public lands include the Koch brothers, are multi-billionaire political organizers who have spent a long time promoting the idea that public lands ought to be just opened up and privatized for ranching and for any other uses. The Koch brothers have oil interests. They have their own cattle ranch, which includes public lands. The work that they're doing and the way they spend their money and the way they marshal their political influence is much more important than the ranchers. But the ranchers are the foreground because they're so picturesque and they kind of win our hearts because Americans like you and me, or me at least, think of ourselves as part cowboy.
So I guess this is my last question. I mean, we've just really skimmed the surface here because there's so much more in this book. And by the way, I want to say this book is just beautifully written, too. It's a terrific read. Yeah. But what can we do? I mean, other than the general thing of, you know, calling our congressman or, you know, certainly voting. But more specifically, is there a particular issue right now or campaign that people can connect with just to begin to push back on this land grab by private interests of our public lands?
I think we're in a turbulent enough time politically that some really good opportunities have opened up to rethink, while we're rethinking a lot about our political system, to rethink our priorities for our public lands. It takes about 5 keystrokes and maybe 15 seconds on your browser to find a long list of opportunities if you want to engage with defending national parks and public lands. There are a lot of very good groups doing really good work on that and on where it intersects with climate change. And often those groups are also focusing on the influence of money and private interests. So I don't think those opportunities are hard to find. I wouldn't be able to pick a single issue to work on. I think whatever interests a listener or a reader or any citizen, they can pick up any of those threads and just follow them to being more active, to being available for help of various kinds politically, whether it's writing your congressman or making a donation or knocking on doors to get out the vote. More of us are going to be called on more of the time to do those simple citizenly things because nobody else is taking care of the parks unless we do. And nobody else is taking care of the political system either.
Well, that's such an important point to make. Well, Stephen Nash, you are the author of Grand Canyon for Sale, Public Lands versus Private Interests in the Era of Climate Change. I want to thank you so much for not only speaking with us here, but for writing this book.
And thank you so much. What a nice opportunity. I appreciate it.
Stephen Nash, in addition to Grand Canyon for Sale, he's the author of Virginia Climate Fever, How Global Warming Will Transform Our Cities, Shorelines, and Forests, as well as other books and articles. There's more to our interview with Stephen Nash at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. And hey, if you get the Writer's Voice podcast from iTunes, please consider going onto iTunes and liking us. It really helps to expand the reach of the show. Thanks so much.